Hi to all of you. Really nice to see you. I had a very, well, yeah, it was interesting in one sense, but very different kind of time since we last met. And because in my mind, it's all mixed up into one big image, it's going to be a little bit difficult for me to get this lecture rolling. What's going to be, it's like, as I'm trying to figure it out. So bear with me. If you remember, we ended up last time talking about transcribing these talks and trying to make sense of them, and then we could publish them as essays. So behind the scenes, we were having kind of like a discussion about this. But then Mahashaya brought up a very interesting point. He said, but I already did that, and you already made a book out of that. And then he said, which was even more interesting, that what we're really doing here is not discussing words or concepts. We're doing something different. So I thought about that. I thought, yeah, he's right. I don't consciously do anything in these lectures. I know that sounds weird, but I have to confess. My mind is completely blank. There's nothing up there. I don't have a plan. I don't have an outline. Sometimes, very rarely, like once every 20 lectures, I come up with an outline. Each time before I lecture, I go to my temple room, sit with my deities, and get some images of what to do, some direction. And as soon as I walk out of my temple room, I forget it completely, because it's not required to run it over in the memory. In fact, memory has nothing to do with this. Now, I'm going to explain why I'm talking about this. I have been asked by Brahmatirtha, who's running the BI, the Bhaktivedanta Institute, to talk about fifth canto things. And for years, I've been discussing this and trying to help them understand more the possible physics of it, to try to connect those descriptions with the cosmology available to the astronomers and astrophysicists. And I've been doing okay with that. Each time I have a discussion with them, I bring them to another understanding. I'm trying very hard to pace this development so that as many people as possible join in the effort to try to make sense of all this. And pretty much I do this on my own. But two presentations ago, he's a doctorate in this stuff. One of the devotees there, his name is Murali, he poked something. He asked me something. And I said, yeah, I'm aware of that problem, but I don't want to talk about it now to ruin my whole presentation. And as soon as I walked out the door, I started thinking about that. So the next presentation, which was last Saturday, or two Saturdays ago, I don't remember when it was exactly on that theme, but expanding it more. So we solved most of the problems we had to solve regarding this dealing with math and science and physics, all the stuff that's available to us. We got pretty good on that, pretty far. But afterwards, the same person, Murali, came up and again poked in a new direction. But this time I said to myself, yeah, he's getting it. The next task is to make sense of these places where people live and how this realm, all those descriptions of these sub-heavenly kind of places, how that relates to this realm with an added dimension of existence. Now, most of those who think in terms of rationality and logic and reason feel it's a hopeless cause, but they're just thinking, well, let's hear something. So last Wednesday, just a couple of days ago, myself, Brahmatirtha, Murli, and this amazing girl, Christina, who's a Harvard graduate from, well, also working in the Krishna Center here, who's working in the game industry, but now is otherwise engaged. We sat together in a personal meeting, and we started talking about the mystical aspects, how the mystical dimensionality, mystical spaces, locations relate to this endeavor to make sense of this. And I don't know why, but I really started pushing it. I mean, really pushing the envelope, pushing the limits, going further, speaking to devotee people further than I have gone before. So it became a mystic group, and they want to meet again. And then Kamalamala asked me, do I want to give a lecture today? And then I was thinking, you know, you guys already know this stuff. You've been there. Own way, you think about these things, you examine these things, you play with these things, because that's what we do. You remember last time I said, it's just some words, you know, I don't want to do the cream puff of words, because in between these words is this energy which we are riding on. It's not my energy. It's our energy. I send out a greeting. You respond with an acknowledgement. In computer lingo, this is what goes on in any interaction between two things. It boils down to get and put. I mean, it boils down to in the stack, on the out of the stack. It's a very logical with zeros and ones. There's this one, there's that one, the way it moves. There's gates and transistors which open and close and divert and move. Just like when you send an email, your email server says, I'm here. The server on the other side says, hello. They start to make a handshake and a protocol for the interaction. I sent you this much. Okay, I got this much. Okay, send more. All right, here's more. This is like a basic formula that all things use. It's how we relate as people. It's how our interactions take place. It's how our personal relationships develop. Here, this is something. Yes, I got it. Tell me more. Or here, here's a response. Just think of those interactions where, here, I'm saying something. Okay, when do they stop? They stopped. Okay, here, I'm saying something. No acknowledgement. Most things nowadays are like that. It's oppositions. And therefore, there is so much friction. That's why the planet is heating up. Friction because of opposition amongst people, amongst the environment, in economics, in politics, in sociology. It's all this opposition. If I wanted to impress you, let's say, I would think I have to say something so amazing that you would go, wow, mainly because, wow, I don't even understand that, but wow, that sounds very fancy. I've mentioned it before, but once I was giving a program in Hungary, I think it was like 1980 or some 81 or something like that. And one lady said to me, this can't be spiritual. It's too simple. Spiritual things have to be incomprehensible. Spiritual things have to be far beyond this intellectual capacity. So I can't possibly understand it. So what do? I talk in such a way that I take things that are known and I assemble all these known things, and something becomes obvious that is very important. Because this is also how I am. Now, there are those who may engage in Sankhya Yoga with incredible jnana and all this analysis and all of this rationality and all this figuring everything out. Krishna says in Gita, they ultimately get to me. The same way those who act in devotion, those who are working in the energy of love, those who are making connection with the divine, get to Krishna. But what we do here in our interactions through these different talks and everything for the last 24 or 25 years is simply a way of connection, continuous connection, and therefore sharing of information and energy. I'm resonating with you. You are resonating with me. We resonate together. And there is a theme to this. That theme is an environment. While we are doing this, we are in our own environment. What makes an impression on us is this environment we create, not the words. It's almost impossible to create an environment like this with words. Now, it can be done with words when you're a really good author. Let's say you're J.K. Rowling and you're making Harry Potter books. Everybody's completely into that environment. But how they see that environment is very much based on these images which they are being fed. They are not participating in it. They are absorbed by it. This is a very important point. They are not participating in the creation of this. Those books exist separate from them. They can not read it for a year, come back, and they're still in the exact same kind of a vision of that environment which is being given to them. The mystical tradition, traditionally, I know that's redundant, but is given by one person to other people through this personal connection, because that's how the environment is created. And within that environment, there can be growth. You can be in the environment of Harry Potter, but the growth doesn't happen. It's just something that impresses you. It's just as if I were to speak to you all these words which were coming at you to, with some motive, who knows what, doesn't matter, coming at you. But in this environment, there's coming to me. So we are together creating this environment. It is its own space. It is its own location. So where is it? This is the question. Usually we never ask it. We assume the answer because to us it's obvious. As soon as I asked you, where is it? Everybody went, whoa. And then as soon as everybody went, oh, we were all like just out of it momentarily. So let's come back in this environment. You're all invited. I don't have to invite you because you helped create it. We never ask, where is it? Because it's obvious. It's right here. We don't ask, when is it? It's right now. So it's right here. It's right now. It's us. This is it. And it's unique. It has its own particular flavor, its own signature. And it's different each time. And it does not depend on what I say. And that, for me, makes me wonder sometimes, like, well, shouldn't I be doing more? Shouldn't I be like writing something? Or shouldn't I be like, you know, making something published? Or isn't that what people do? And sure, that's what people do, but that's not what I do. So that's why I like this like small group invitation only. And I liked it also with this group of people with the BI, because Small group, invitation only, environment created, everybody's assisting. We are making a connection. We are making a location. And that is the key to understanding the Dwipas and the various personalities who live there. That is the key to understanding the celestial realm. I'll give you a dimensional example just for fun. Because Merle, he said to me, he said, I have a problem with other beings bumping into me here. Now, he doesn't know it yet, but this is the key to the next step, beings bumping into you. If you all share the same space and the same location, there's going to be beings walking through you. But let's talk about right here, us.
And us.
Our environment. Are there beings walking through it? Is there anything in it except us? No, we don't feel it. We never think about it. Let's talk about this mathematically. Let's use some plain old geometry. We live basically in three dimensions, height and width and depth and all that jazz. We can locate. Okay, let's go back to the dimensions. You got three dimensions. Any point in our reality, wherever we are, can be graphed in three dimensions. Even planets can be graphed in three dimensions. Of course, it's more difficult and you have to figure out the way to orient your dimensional graph, but you can do it. Let's take two dimensions, just simply like you have a line meeting a line in two-dimensional space, length and width, that's all. Now, a two-dimensional space and a three-dimensional space will only meet at one point, which is a line. And what's so cool is how thick is that line? Well, it's not thick at all, because if a line has thickness, it has more than length and width, length and width, it has height. So even when I say that the two-dimensional box meets the three-dimensional cube at one point, what does that actually mean? That means you could have beings walking all over the three-dimensional cube here and there on stairs and airplanes and cars and wheels. And the two-dimensional down there might not even be affected at all. So let's go back to our space that we created together. We feel it. We know it exists. We know where it is and when it is. And because of who we are, we also know exactly how it is. Can you locate it in three-dimensional space? No, you can't. Gora is in St. Petersburg. Kamalamala is in Moscow, near Stockholm. I'm in Florida. What we do makes no sense three-dimensionally. Somebody who's into the science of stuff could say it doesn't exist because it cannot be described properly in a way which makes rational sense. But we know it exists. We wouldn't listen to such a person because we know they don't know what they're talking about. So let's call that another dimension. And in the same way, the two-dimensional doesn't intersect with the three-dimensional, except for maybe at a point. The three-dimensional doesn't intersect with the four-dimensional, except maybe at a point, or maybe at a cube, or maybe a tangent of a plane. A tangent is when, like, you know, you have a sphere and a line and they meet at this point, that's a tangent. So all of a sudden, this became very interesting. This idea of location becomes more interesting. The idea of these other things which are discussed in the Bhagavatam become more accessible. It's one thing to say it's in another dimension and have no idea what you're talking about. It's another thing to say it's in another dimension and know exactly what you're talking about. One is simply Gan, the other is Vigan. And if you start thinking in terms of, well, there's us here, there's the celestial realm, there's the Vaikuntha realm, there's the Goloka realm, then you start to understand the requirements to be there. Now, there's another point here, which is interesting. The science of materials. Not material, materials like steel or cement or liquids, water or gases, the materials you use to do things with, the stuff that makes up existence. When we, our consciousness is absorbed in this body is made of materials, which allows our senses to tune to the materials that are in the same field of activities outside of us. So the materials which this body is made of exist very much within the three-dimensional realm. So our default perception with our senses is within the three-dimensional realm. Now, when we make this us, when we make this environment, we're outside of that realm, but it doesn't work exactly the same way because something's missing. And what's important to understand is something that's also discussed in the Bhagavatam or other literatures, that the bodies of these individuals in these other realms are different. Their materials are different, and their senses, which are attuned to those materials, are different. So what they see and how they interact is different. So generally speaking, we cannot interact with that in the same way they do. Now, someone may say, oh, my God, well, that proves we are going to stay materialist forever. We are forever bound in this world of stuff, and that's all there is to it, and it can never change. Well, if that's true, then I should shut up. We should shut down this thing, go home, and, you know, make some pancakes. No, but we don't do that because we have some other experience. So now what we have to do is figure out the interface between that and this and us. So when we're in front of the deities and we accept the conversation, we accept, we say, hello, how are you? They reply, we continue the conversation. Where is that happening? Well, as soon as it's happening with the mind, then the conversation dies. And it has nothing to do with intelligence. And okay, false ego, terrible word, has nothing to do with that either. It's a direct spiritual connection with the divine. But we're still with this stuff. We live in this stuff. We're putting pants and shirts and skirts on this stuff. But we're feeling the divine. That's because that spiritual being we are is the right substance to have that connection and live in that connection. We are able to connect to, communicate with, and understand and live within the energy of the divine. The celestial, much harder. And that may seem strange, but that is a dimensional thing. It requires a different set of sensual whatever in order to interact with it. This stuff with the pants and shirt stands in front of the deity on the altar who's made of marble or wood. And because of that, these eyes directly perceive. Doesn't matter what state of consciousness you're in. And then when you start to connect to your divinity, you understand the divinity of the deity who has been called to reside here. It transforms. And it has to do with lacking of resonating substance or lacking of resonated senses because it's our natures. That non-difference allows us to feel, to resonate with the divine energy of the deity. And the difference allows us to communicate. The difference allows us to connect. It's a perfect package. In any body, in any dimension, in any resonance that exists. But the interconnectivity of different bodies of stuff with different senses that work within that stuff to others in the same situation, but in other dimensions, is not necessarily possible for almost everybody. Therefore, nobody's walking through us. Therefore, we're not bumping into anybody. Therefore, we're not even necessarily sharing the same space. So the best we can possibly aim for when understanding the fifth canto is to just say, this is how it works. You can describe it. You can even make a media presentation about it and show it in media, but almost certainly you're never going to perceive it directly. This realm, these universes, this material world is compartmentalized, departmentalized. It's in various pieces. And as far as we understand in the divine, there is no fragmentation. There's this connection, this oneness, because it's never broken. I'm kind of needing a break because that was heavy stuff. And I think that Janame Jai is perfectly expressing right now exactly. I mean, this has been very visual Zoom, and we've had Kamala Mala, who is in and out of dimensions and was probably flying all over the universe. So I'd like to just end this section with saying, you guys are great. We're back. Do emotions have dimensions? Or are they the same in all dimensions? And if it is so, then the difference between dimensions doesn't mean so much, isn't it? I think the question is phrased a little bit upside down. People have emotions. So the emotions are connected to the individuals. Not only people, living entities have feelings. It's easier to understand if we set aside the word emotion, because that's generally understood to have something to do with people. An emotion is a feeling. All living entities more or less have feeling. And the feelings are connected to the individuals. And the individuals live in different dimensions. So the individuals with emotions live in dimensions. So these emotions do not live, these emotions are not dimensional. They don't have a dimension. But you can find them in a dimension when they're connected to a living being. So from that point of view, the differences in dimensions, again, boil down to the individuals, not to their emotions. Okay, here's another one. Boy, you guys really come up with wild questions. Can one say that in some sense, the idea of a flat earth, I know some strong supporters of it, can refer to the blueprint, a vague attempt to describe the universe, but which is limited by its own means? Flat earth is really a strange concept. First of all, the Bhagavatam also does not speak about a flat earth. And those who talk about flat earth in regular society certainly don't know anything about the Bhagavatam. So these two groups of people may have a similar idea, but for totally different reasons. The people who think about flat earth, who actually live on this earth and are not referring to a scripture, are just wrong. There's no theoretical justification for this idea. Those who do it from the point of view of trying to explain the fifth canto description have an incomplete understanding of the description. And if they think that that description describes what's actually going on this planet, well, then they go into the same category of these other flat earthers who are wrong. But in your question, you say it's a vague attempt to describe the universe. I would rephrase that question to say it's an attempt to make sense of a description. They have no idea what it's referring, what the description refers to. Each and every one of us tries to find our truth or tries to find our understanding in whatever way we can. And if that methodology brings us somewhere useful, then I can't really complain about it. And I think that's the inference of this question. And from that point of view, yes, that's so. Okay, here's the next one, which is much bigger. When you asked a probably rhetorical question about what is the space created during such communication made of, it did not sound quite rhetorical to me. No, it wasn't a rhetorical question. So we agreed. And I did answer by saying we know what it is by direct perception, but we don't question it. Neither do we need to define it because we know it. The only problem would be is if we have to explain it to somebody else, then it becomes really difficult. Then you have to start using words and arrange them into conceptual descriptions, which you're not going to be happy with. Okay, continuing with the question. My restless mind got puzzled, and started looking for possible answers for it. I immediately remembered everything that is known from esotericism about the astral world, about the etheric plane and all that. But then, largely thanks to your explanation, you're welcome, I began to come to understand that no matter the subtle plan is, plane you must mean, in which each of us, possibly each in our own way, attunes with the common space of communication, at the heart of our communication itself is, or lies, if you will, a single divine being, spirit, if you like, oh my goodness, so many parentheses. Summarized, we are all eternally connected. Yes, okay, sure. Could you somehow correct this vision of mine or supplement it if it's not? No, I don't want to correct it. It's all fine. But I did describe that the resonance of materials, the resonance that creates what we know as sensual perception, that is a reflection through our divine perception that exists independently or not independent, yeah, independently, but exists as the foundation and fundament of all that perception and consciousness. It is our perception and consciousness, resonates with the materials of that particular existence. So that's just the added dimension to it that I think you need. I agreed with you, and that's the reason why. You know, that was amazing because I just threw on you a whole pot of spaghetti with all kinds of sauce and cheese. And you made sense of it?
Yeah, because it seems to me at least that there was some sense in it.
I didn't even know what I was talking about when I was speaking. I got so lost in the middle of my... She does that with her questions, you know. It's like you want to take the whole spaghetti and go boom in the column. Yeah. You know, that's it's right. Tough stuff.
That's true.
Okay. All right. Next sentence. Can we say that Supreme made, wait a minute, the Supreme made different dimensions for the mean that we human here? Hang on, I gotta figure this out. Perhaps the question is meaning that these differing dimensions are to keep us from mixing with other places.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. It's like, you know, you got the valet parking at the Ritz Hotel, and then you got a motel off the motorway. You get what you pay for according to your status, according to your class, according to your wealth. You're placed in different dimensions, even here on Earth. So this very much makes sense, but the bank is the bank of karma, and you know, good results, that your pious results that you're spending. Question number four, is that a Google translation or did you do it? Because I don't get the second part. Read it, Maha. Is it correct?
In the description of Lilith of Krishna.
No, is this an indication? Is that sentence correctly translated?
It's an indication of that what is described here is a different dimension.
Well, there are huge numbers in the description of Krishna Leelas in the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam. Is this an indication that it is this a description of another dimension? Are you speaking about Krishna Leela here on this planet? I guess that's what you mean, right? Okay. I don't really know exactly how to answer that. I would not want to start placing that description in a dimensional context. The reason I did that with the celestial jazz, not even up to celestial, but this thing in the fifth canto, is because of helping to create an image of a framework that fits within this description so that people can understand it better. That's the only reason. Me personally, I don't want to live in a dimensional space like that. I don't want to think like that. I don't want to feel like that. Because when you get into love, love has no dimension. One of the problems when you speak of dimension is limits. And when you talk about divine love, divine consciousness, limits just don't fit. Now, obviously, you can say it's a different environment. And when you're in that environment, it's a totally different experience than when you're here. But you would never consider it as a dimensional space. Now, I could have easily just said, yeah, sure. Yeah, you're right. But that would be a terrible answer. I think the better answer is that, yeah, no, I don't want to touch that with bring that into Krishna Leela dimensions. Ooh, no. Can our human feeling, this is an interesting question. Can our feeling, us here, us human guys, be felt by the inhabitants of other realms? And can we feel their feelings? Cool question. When you say humans, who are you referring to? Humans don't even have a clue of the existence of the celestial realm. So when it comes to feeling, to feel what they feel is very difficult. Yet, the anger or the punishment or the reaction, these are feelings. Yes, we can experience that. And we can also feel loving, caring, concern. Obviously, they can directly connect to our feelings. In fact, that's what demigods are doing as they regulate our existence here. The devas, this is part of their existence. And especially when we create this us, as this global community or specific parts, that feeling is powerful. And of course it's perceived, because feelings very much energetically resonate, and energy is not as easily limited as stuff is. I could get into a whole discussion of resonance and deep resonance and high resonance and speed versus slow versus distance versus, it could be very interesting, but that would take too long. So remind me some other day. Now, as far as forging life on the moon in another dimension, yeah, sure, that's the easy answer. You want a more specific answer? Very difficult. Can we say Bhumi perceived feelings of people, so she decided to approach Lord Brahma? Well, Bhumi referring to Mother Earth, of course Mother Earth perceives our feelings. In fact, this is what's causing the resonance of everything that's happening today. And the Earth directly reacts to the way in which we treat the earth and all those on it. Okay, I guess we quit there. And I hope this wasn't too, I don't know. Was everything I said understandable? Maybe.
We need to listen two more times.
Really?